Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Thanks for coming along tonight to hear Roy Williams address the Sydney Institute for the first time. I'll introduce him briefly on the occasion of the publication of In God They Trust, the religious beliefs of Australia's Prime Ministers from 1901 to 2013. Roy Williams won the Sydney University Medal in Law in 1986 and practised as a litigator for almost 20 years as one of the country's leading legal firms here in Sydney. He now writes full-time. His first book, God Actually, A Rational Defence of Christianity, was a bestseller in Australia and has since been published in Britain and in North America. And, of course, Roy writes regularly for the Australian Reviewing and other pieces. So it's great to have Roy Williams here today to talk on the topic of In God They Trust, Australia's Prime Ministers. Many thanks.
Well, ladies and gentlemen, it really is a terrific honour to be asked to address the Sydney Institute. I've long admired both Gerard and Anne for their contribution to the intellectual life of Australia. But most of all, I admire their preparedness to provide a forum for views that may differ from their own. And I should also acknowledge that a number of their own books in relation to Joe and Enid Lyons and the Liberal Party in general proved most invaluable resources in my research for In God They Trust. Now, the writing of this book very much was a labour of love for me because it traverses the two subjects that interest me the most, Christianity and politics, and the interplay between them in an Australian context. But I pose the rhetorical question against myself, why should the general reader be interested? Well, for fellow believers in the Christian religion, I expect that sheer curiosity may be one reason. Many of our Prime Ministers are household names, and all 23 of them were intelligent and capable people. And as it happens, they represent a good cross-section of every shade of Christian adherence and agnosticism. A few, indeed, were talented amateur theologians, and the four who stand out in that regard were Alfred Deakin, our second Prime Minister and one of the greatest, and I'll come to him in a moment, that amazing, irascible old character, Billy Hughes, Sir Robert Menzies, our longest-serving leader and undoubtedly one of the most distinguished, and our current Prime Minister, Kevin Rudd. Now, after researching the lives of all 23 of these people, I concluded that they were atypical of the population as a whole, in that they were considerably more religiously minded than the average Australian at any point in our history. Of the 23, 16, in my judgment, were believers in God. There may be a bit of argument around the edges in relation to a few of them. And even in relation to the seven unbelievers, most of them thought long and hard about God. Bob Hawke is a prime example, of course. His father was a Congregationalist minister, and Hawke himself was a serious practicing Christian until his early 20s. I'd classify only two of our Prime Ministers as lifelong agnostics. Edmund Barton, the first, although some categorise him as a liberal or formal Anglican, he was certainly a formal Anglican, And the other was Harold Holt. He's probably the only open and shut case of unbelief. And I think there have been no atheists. I, for one, am far from convinced that Julia Gillard is really an atheist. And I'm happy to answer questions on that. But certainly as a girl in Adelaide, she grew up steeped in the Baptist tradition. But again, some people may ask, well, so what, Roy? How is any of this relevant? Well, my starting premise is this. Australia is a truly great country. And surely our 23 prime ministers deserve at least some of the credit for that. Overall, I would argue Australia has been well led. Now, my second starting premise is that genuine religious belief is, or certainly ought to be, a key determinant of personal behaviour and of political behaviour. For faith without deeds is dead. And I argue in the book that the religious beliefs of many of our leaders had important earthly consequences. Now, I want to begin with just one case study, and that's Alfred Deakin. Deakin's story, in my opinion, should give pause even to hardcore secularists. He served three separate terms as Prime Minister between 1903 and 1910. And he was the most influential figure during the first decade of the Australian nation. What Deakin believed became Australia. A lively patriotism, the rule of law, strong defence, assistance for Australian industry, centralised wage fixation, and a reasonable safety net for the working classes and the elderly. And the big blot on his record, though even this must be understood in historical context, the White Australia policy. Now, Paul Kelly has dubbed that policy mix the Australian settlement. And there might be arguments in retrospect, with the benefit of hindsight, as to the desirability of all of it. But there can be no question that Deakin, our founding father, was a good and brilliant man. He was a lawyer by training, exceptionally well-read, exceptionally intelligent. And he was also the most religiously minded Prime Minister in our history. Now, Deakin was not a conventional Christian, but he believed in God as the creator of all things and as the ultimate foundation of morality, and he believed in an afterlife. He also believed in a personal God, and he once wrote, for example, "Always I realise the existence of God. Always I believe in him with my intellect and turn to him with my heart." Now, this is the key point. Throughout his career, Deakin was driven by a sense of mission above all. He wrote hundreds of private prayers, many works of amateur theology. He almost became a minister of religion twice. And often he beseeched God for help. For example, in 1898, he wrote a prayer in which he prayed that his career might be the means of creating and fostering throughout all Australia a Christ-like citizenship. That's how he saw the Australian settlement, as the fulfilment of his and Australia's divine destiny, the practical implementation of the Lord's Prayer, the coming of the kingdom on earth. Now, that all sounds highfalutin and grandiloquent, certainly, but that is what Deakin himself wrote in his private journal in January 1908. So his is perhaps the clearest personal example. But my overall thesis, as I say, is that in many cases, the religious beliefs of our prime ministers mattered. Not always for the good, but they mattered. And this evening, I just want to touch upon the three perennial issues of practical politics: war and peace, distribution of wealth, and human rights. Now, I'll take first decision-making in wartime. In my view, the decision whether or not to wage war is or should be the most grave that any national leader can make. And in the Christian tradition, this may sound strict, but in the Christian tradition there are really only two valid attitudes towards war. One is pacifism, and the second is the so-called just war doctrine, rigorously and conscientiously applied. Now, I'm bound to say that the three Australian Prime Ministers with the keenest anti-war instincts were not driven primarily by Christianity. This is not a coincidence. They were the men who had actually seen serious combat as young men. Stanley Melvyn Bruce, who was wounded on the Western Front in World War I, and John Gorton and Gough Whitlam, both of whom served in the Air Force in World War II. Gorton was twice shot down. Now, I expect the horrors of war no doubt have to be experienced in person to be fully understood. But I argue that religion has played a part too. Now, I draw a distinction in the book between what I call Old Testament Christians and New Testament Christians. Both are sincere, but their preoccupations tend to be different. New Testament Christians tend to emphasise charity and mercy and the ever-present possibility of redemption, whereas Old Testament Christians tend to emphasise personal righteousness, diligence and loyalty. And they believe that people who don't conform to those tenets, whether individuals or groups in society or indeed entire countries, deserve God's wrath. Now, during World War I, Australia had three prime ministers, Joseph Cook, Andrew Fisher and Billy Hughes, the little digger himself. Two of them, Cook and Hughes, were quintessential Old Testament Christians. They both, very admirably, clawed their way to the top from humble, lower middle class, Protestant origins in Britain. Cook was a Methodist and Hughes was he came from a combined background of Anglicanism and Welsh baptism. The third Prime Minister, Andrew Fisher, who remains to this day the only Labour Prime Minister who was a lifelong Protestant, was a New Testament Christian. Now, Fisher had been a very fine peacetime Prime Minister, but he began his third and last term just a month into World War I, and he retired in despair just over a year later. Fisher was the only one of the six then living Prime Ministers who opposed conscription in World War I, and he refused to sign a petition that Hughes presented to him in its favour during the plebiscites in 1916 and 1917. It was Joseph Cook who declared war on Australia's behalf. And throughout the war, he was only Prime Minister for a month or so, but he became Billy Hughes' deputy when Hughes switched over from Labor to the Nationalists. And near the end of the war, and this to me is an Old Testament Christian speaking, near the end of the war, at which time 30 million people had died, including 60,000 Australians almost, Cook was still completely unrepentant and opposed any form of negotiation in September 1918. He said, "This is not a war for arranging and negotiating and fixing up. It is a struggle for two conflicting ideals. You cannot negotiate a thing like that. This is biblical language. There is only one thing you can do about it. Either the light must drive out the darkness, or it must be submerged by the darkness." Now, I've mentioned the conscription plebiscites, and they both failed narrowly during World War I. Billy Hughes, of course, is infamous for having inflamed religious sectarianism to a tragic degree during those conscription votes by painting especially Irish Catholic opponents of conscription as disloyal to the country. And sadly, I have to point out that Hughes justified his conduct to himself in religious terms. He wrote, for example, to Keith Murdoch, the Keith Murdoch, in November 1916. This is Hughes writing, "I believe I have a mission and that God gives me strength to do it." Hughes and Cook then represented Australia at the Versailles Conference in 1919, and they went there unashamedly thirsting for revenge. Hughes openly advocated the pulverisation of Germany. He spoke of exacting an eye for an eye. He called this the gospel, my gospel. And at Versailles, he fought tooth and nail against a proposed racial equality clause in the Covenant of the League of Nations, and he prevailed. Woodrow Wilson eventually gave in to him. He said, "All right, you pestiferous varmint, you can have it." It's true. So that's World War One. And the Versailles Treaty, of course, was perhaps the key event in the history of the 20th century because it led to everything else. Let's jump forward to the 1930s. In this period, Australia was led by two prime ministers who were the closest we've ever had to being pacifists, the opposite of Cook and Hughes. Both were devout Catholics. First, it was Jim Scullin, the Labor Prime Minister during the Depression. He'd probably be my nomination for the best Christian man who has ever been Prime Minister of Australia. But that's of course, a very different thing to the best Christian Prime Minister. Scullin was a failure as Prime Minister. But he did once say, and imagine any leader saying this today, Scullin once said, "I do not pretend to be a military expert, and the Lord forbid I ever should be one." Now, Lyons, who succeeded Scullin, the leader of the newly formed United Australia Party, the new conservative force formed to defeat Labor, Lyons, throughout the 1930s, supported every attempt by the British government to negotiate peace with Nazi Germany. He generally was a peacemaker, or tried to be. He utilised his ties with the Vatican twice to obtain audiences with Mussolini, and he intervened directly with Neville Chamberlain, the British Prime Minister, who was a close friend of his, during the German occupation of the Sudetenland in 1938. And some historians indeed credit Lyons for the vital breakthrough, so to speak, at the Munich Conference, which was greeted almost everywhere at the time with great joy. Appeasement is a dirty word now, but it's important to remember that everything Lyons did in the 30s was in the light of the dreadful memories of World War One. The prospect of a repeat with modern weapons was literally unthinkable, and his extremely deep-seated abhorrence of war. Now, he actually made enemies within the UOP. Keith Murdoch, again, in January 1939, wrote in exasperation to a colleague that, "I don't know what we can get out of Lyons, but his wife is an ardent pacifist, even a belligerent pacifist. When he speaks, she speaks. When he gives a Christian message, she gives one. Her message always, if we love our neighbours enough, there will be no war." It is very pitiful. Now, I acknowledge that the wisdom of appeasement, in retrospect, and Britain's sudden abandonment of it, in September 39, is a massive subject, and it's a controversial subject. But in my opinion, the message of Joe and Enid Lyons, far from being pitiful, was sensible and judicious. And Lyons, too, had a strong belief in the sanctity of human life, the sanctity of individual conscience, and for that reason he opposed conscription in the 1930s. It seems to me that at all times, whatever else might be said of Lyons, he behaved as a Christian. It may not be the best thing in the harsh world of real politics, but when you're assessing the great Christian prime ministers, he has to be one of them. Now, there's a lot more I could say about war, leaders such as Menzies and John Curtin, but let me turn to a somewhat happier subject, and that's the second perennial issue of practical politics, the distribution of wealth. Now, Australia has a deserved reputation for egalitarianism. I'd argue that Christianity played a positive role in the shaping of that ethos. Yes, there are disparities of wealth. There always have been, but they've never been as pronounced here as in, say, Britain or the United States. Now, there are a few factors at play here. I'm not pretending religion is the only one of them. But it's interesting that the majority of our Labor prime ministers were either Protestant Christian socialists or from that tradition. Fisher, the preeminent example, personal friend of Keir Hardie, the Christian socialist, the first member of the House of Commons from the Labor Party. The pre-Federation Joseph Cook was also a Christian socialist. The pre-World War I Billy Hughes described himself as a Christian socialist. And more recently, Kevin Rudd, among other things, has described himself as a Christian socialist. The second strain, of course, is the Catholic social justice tradition. Leaders like Scullin, Ben Chifley, Paul Keating, and, of course, Rudd again, as a child, because he was raised as a Catholic. Now, these two traditions were central to the formation of the ALP. Possible to understand the formation of the ALP without that religious background. And of course, it was Ben Chifley who coined the phrase, which is still the ALP's catch cry, the light on the hill, and he drew it from the Sermon on the Mount. I just want to read one little passage from a letter Chifley wrote in 1950, right near the end of his life. He said that all those who seek to spread the gospel of Christ are, I feel, duty-bound to follow his own rule of life to help the lowly to better things, which was shown, I think, in the New Testament. Now, then there was a third group of Labor leaders, made up of people who, adopting Gough Whitlam's term, were fellow travellers with Christianity. And I'd place in that category Whitlam himself, as well as Chris Watson, the first Labor Prime Minister, Curtin, Hawke, and most recently Julia Gillard, and all five have fascinating religious stories. Let me turn now to the conservative side of politics, and I'd argue that the ameliorating influence of Christianity has also been very strong there. Almost all of Australia's non-Labor prime ministers were practising or at least cultural Christians. And with the strange exception of Cook and the partial exception of S.M. Bruce, none of them were uncritical worshippers of the market. So Barton and Deakin were progressive protectionists who actually relied on Labor support to stay in office. The free trader George Read, who incidentally was the son of a Presbyterian minister, preached down at Scott's Church just down the road. Read believed something similar. He was a fulsome anti-socialist, but he'd actually led a very enlightened government in New South Wales before Federation. And Billy Hughes himself was in the same category. Even after he defected from the ALP, he, at least in his economic policies, he never forgot his humble origins. The Depression, of course, was a watershed. Labor floundered. For almost 40 of the next 50 years, Australia was led by a series of fiscally moderate prime ministers from the Conservative side. And I argue that all of them, except Harold Holt, were deeply influenced by Christianity. Lyons, of course, who I've mentioned, began his career in the ALP, had a sensitive social conscience derived from Catholicism. Robert Menzies, for all his anti-socialist rhetoric, he was very good at that. At heart, he was a Puritan. He had an old-fashioned barrister's distaste for money grubbers and the big end of town. And policy-wise, he was a moderate Keynesian. And so, after he left office, even more so, was Stanley Melvin Bruce. And so were John Gorton, Billy McMahon, perhaps slightly less so than the others, and, of course, Malcolm Fraser. And I argue in the book that the world views of each of them had religious roots, and I'm happy to elaborate on that. It might be said that John Howard was the outlier, so to speak, in this regard. But even so, I would argue that at least in government, Howard was considerably less fiscally extreme or less pure, everyone wants to put it, more prepared to compromise than a good number of his Liberal Party colleagues. And indeed, Howard once professed to having a social justice streak inherited from his childhood Methodism. And I believe.
Oh, 5 minutes,
sir. I'll conclude just by saying a few things about human rights, which is a vexed subject very much in today's news. The history of Australia in the 20th century, broadly speaking, had two themes in terms of human rights. The first was sectarianism, the Catholic-Protestant divide, which I've alluded to. And in practical terms, the key issue was the question of state aid to religious schools. And I just mentioned the role played by two of our leaders in... It was a long and tortuous process, but two of our leaders in ultimately resolving that terrible schism. First, of course, was Menzies. He believed passionately that education cannot be pagan without being destructive. And it was Menzies who, in the lead-up to the 1963 election, made the famous promise to fund the building of science blocks in both government and independent schools. And I venture to say that in 1963, only Menzies could have taken this step, because he had immense authority within the coalition and the country at large. He was unimpeachably Protestant, and he also had a very respectable record as regards sectarianism. He confessed in his memoir, The Measure of the Years, that from my very earliest days it nauseated me. And in one of his famous radio addresses in 1942, he denounced sectarianism in plain terms as the denial of Christianity, not its proof. Now, on the Labor side, of course, the key figure was Gough Whitlam. He fought an internal battle throughout much of the 1960s against, within the ALP, both Protestants and secularists, to convince the party that it had to change its policy and support state aid. And he finally won that battle at the 1969 Federal Conference. And then he appointed a genuinely serious Protestant Christian, Kim Beazley Sr., as his education spokesman. And he then became education minister in the Whitlam government. And Beazley himself regarded his role in helping to ameliorate sectarianism in education as his... by far his most important achievement in politics. John Howard, I think, deserves praise for his new schools policy of 1998. The point of that initiative was to make it much easier for new low-fee independent schools, mainly Protestant schools, to be started up in geographical areas already serviced by a state school and a Catholic parish school. So there's been an explosion in the number of those schools since 1998. So we now take for granted the funding of religious schools, but a number of our prime ministers had to fight very hard to achieve it. Finally, on the question, the horrible question of race and racial issues. I know I haven't got much time, and I don't quite know where to begin, but... I'd say this, that somewhat disturbingly from a Christian perspective, two of the three prime ministers with the best records on racial issues, Harold Holt and Malcolm Fraser, were unbelievers. And that just leaves Paul Keating. In most respects, I argue, Keating's record on matters of race was very good. And one thing I attempt to do in the book is to dispel the popular notion that Keating was and is a mere tribal Catholic. There's actually a surprising amount of material on the record, and a number of times Keating's linked his beliefs in Catholicism, as he understood it, with his political beliefs. And indeed, in 1997, he spoke, I don't know if it was here, Jared, but he spoke at the launch of Anne's book about the religious order founded by St. Mary MacKillop, the Sisters of St. Joseph. And he sought to explain on that occasion why he admired the nuns so much. He'd been educated by the Josephites, and he extolled their, quote, their fidelity to the poor, their belief in God's interest in them, Christ's interest in them, and their intrinsic importance as his children. Now, Keating always insisted, with that Christian background in mind, Keating always insisted that in order to create and maintain economic growth, and in this, Keating was really a convert, I think, from a Catholic to a Protestant view of political economy. You may not have seen it that way, but in his argument for economic reform, he always tried to draw the link between creating and maintaining economic growth and racial tolerance. He argued Australia couldn't remain a little European enclave in the Pacific. Rather, we had to trade our way into the Southeast Asian community to, if you like, make disciples of all nations. And that really became the central theme of Keating's political career. It never made him popular, and he certainly felt the backlash at the ballot box in 1996. But I would argue he was right. And whatever populist rhetoric may be to the contrary, Keating's vision is really now conventional wisdom on both sides of politics, on both sides. And China, of course, is now a superpower. And I'll just finish, Jared, by posing a rhetorical question. I wonder what Keating makes of the fact that Christianity is now growing faster in China than in any other country of the world. Thank you.
Many thanks to Roy Williams. I should say that In God They Trust, question mark, on Australia's religious beliefs of Australia's Prime Ministers. Janet Grundy's got some copies and it's selling outside. I should compliment the Bible Society on a very fine production. I think it's extremely well done. I must say they've got a bit of experience in this, publishing the well-known bestseller called The Holy Bible, but they've done well with this one. Maybe you call it The Unholy Bible. And I should also make an editorial clarification. When our speaker speaks of 23 prime ministers, he's not including the very short-term prime ministers who spent a week or so of, in my recollections, Mr. Page, Mr. Ford and Mr. McEwen. So that brings us back to 23, the ones who served a substantial period. So we'll come to question discussion, finish at the top of the hour, no later than the top of the hour. Can I start off, if you just come up, Roy? Interested in what your comments on Chifley. I mean, there is some dispute about what Chifley really was, because he gave up his Catholicism to marry outside the church. Some people like to think he came back into the Catholic Church because there's some chair down in Canberra where he allegedly sat in the cathedral. But if you look at some of the letters that he wrote, it looked like he decided that he had left the Catholic Church and didn't come back to it, although someone buried him out of a Catholic church in Bathurst. So how do you find Ben Chifley, and what sort of light does he have on his spiritual hill?
Yeah, I argue, perhaps charitably, I don't know. I argue that Chifley did remain, in substance, a Christian, certainly, and most probably a Catholic, at least in his own mind. It's true he married outside the church, but that doesn't mean, in my view, that he forsook the church. There's quite a lot of evidence that he continued to worship in Catholic churches, both in Bathurst and in Canberra. Chif's chair is an historical factor. I checked that because you told me that you didn't believe in it, but it is, in fact,
I believe in
an
the
historic...
chair.
He's an unbeliever.
It's the nature of the chair.
Well,
the spirituality of the chair, right?
Well, a couple of things. Archie Cameron, the leader of the Country Party for a short while during World War II, is a great gossip, apparently. And if you read Hasluck's memoirs, it's a very funny passage where Archie Cameron reports back to Hasluck often about what Chifley did at Mass. And the story, this was at St. Christopher's, Chifley was a very regular attendee, but he didn't take part in the service. During prayers, he closed his eyes rather than kneeling and always slipped away to avoid the priest's greeting. It's probably true that his relationship with the Catholic Church hierarchy wasn't a particularly friendly one. L.F. Crisp, probably his most eminent biographer, he knew it very well, revealed, I think, the most interesting fact about Chifley, that in the last few years of his life, he read the Bible 11 times. And he corresponded with a local parish priest at Candos, who lent him various works of theology, including one Ronald A. Knox's book on English in the Bible. And when Chifley returned it to the priest, he wrote a little letter and he remarked, "I found it very interesting, and for a work on the subject of the Bible, containing much humour." So I guess I'd argue that Chifley did remain a believer, but obviously fell out with some parts of the church.
Roy, Tim James, congrats on the book, and thanks for your presentation tonight. So we often these days see Kevin Rudd on his way into church. He seems to like to have the press gallery come along and reporting on his attendance at church. My question is has that been the norm, or do prime ministers of faith tend to be perhaps more private, understated, discreet in their practice of their chosen faith?
I think that's a fair comment. The Australians generally tend to be more modest about displaying their faith, and perhaps that's an evangelical fault at times. But certainly Rudd did conduct interviews outside the church in Canberra when he was Prime Minister. I mean, I'm not sure how that began or whose fault it really was. I mean, let me say this. There's absolutely no question in my mind that Kevin Rudd is a sincere Christian, and he's a very learned amateur theologian, and he was actually a lay preacher when he was in China as a diplomat. He knows his stuff. But like many of us, you know, he clearly has his character flaws, and one would hope he has learnt from them the first time around. I hope I don't offend anyone here by saying that Rudd actually reminds me very much of Menzies. Menzies too, the more I read about the early Menzies, the young Menzies, he, like Rudd, came to be actively disliked, even detested by many people within his own party. They lost confidence in him and forced him out. And he had to learn to suffer fools. They were his own words. "I don't suffer..." Archie Cameron again, actually. Said, "Archie, I don't suffer fools gladly." And Archie said, "Well, it might be news to you to learn that we bloody fools have a lot of trouble putting up with you too." So Menzies learnt the lesson. He learnt the lesson the hard way, and one would hope that that Kevin Rudd has too. All I can say is that when I spoke to him, he was perfectly charming. But you know, that was just me.
So you interviewed Kevin Rudd for the book, and
yep.
and also
John Howard.
Yeah. So there's a question here.
Yes, you've talked about Kevin Rudd in regards to being a Christian. A Christian social democrat and redistribution of income, and being a Christian obviously implies that the high moral authority is God, not government. Okay.
Yes.
And what I'm suggesting is that how does he reconcile his differences between the parable of the talents, where people have to make lots of money using your talents, while the Good Samaritan. So he has this conflict between the two that you can't coerce people to be good Samaritans because the moral authority is not government, it is God. And have you interviewed him, say, hey, you're not God.
maybe I ought to put that question to him.
What does the Prime Minister think of the Good Samaritan, I think?
Well, he's certainly written about the parable of the Good Samaritan, and Labour leaders tend to emphasise that parable. Liberal leaders like John Howard tend to emphasise the parable of the talents. The truth is that politics is all about striking an appropriate balance between the two of them. And I'm sure that's what Jesus had in mind in the Gospels. I would say this about the parable of the talents. I don't know that Jesus was really talking about the making of money. I think he was. The fundamental message of the parable of the talents is that we're all called upon to use our individual skills, our individual gifts from God in the most productive way we can. Now that may be making money and then using it usefully. I don't think Kevin Rudd would argue with that. I mean, his wife is an extremely successful businesswoman. But I confess I didn't ask him that specific question.
Lindsay.
It's a tough one.
Whenever a practicing Catholic runs for high office, and I'm thinking of John Kennedy and maybe Tony Abbott, and even leaders of the opposition like Arthur Calwell, they're often challenged on their ability to allow their personal views to override what the doctrine might be or what the Vatican says. Are there examples where Catholic leaders have publicly had that debate with themselves and their church about matters of morality, matters of policy?
In Australia, well, Tony Abbott is interesting on this subject. I've actually written a chapter on Tony Abbott, possible participation of a second edition, Greg, and of events later in the year. Abbott is very interesting on this. He's actually on record as saying that he does believe in the Pope as the vicar of Christ on earth. On the other hand, one can point to very significant issues of public policy in recent years where Abbott has adopted stances that, frankly, are, I mean, whatever one's views on the matter, quite at odds with the Vatican's. The Iraq War is perhaps the prime example. Asylum seekers, in general terms, another. I'm not for a moment questioning the sincerity of Tony Abbott's faith. The conclusion I came to is that it's very deep-seated and crucial to an understanding of the man. But I don't think, if anyone is concerned that Tony Abbott would be constrained by loyalty to the to the Vatican as opposed to Australia, I think that's far-fetched. Mm.
There's a question here, then we go down the back.
Thanks for your talk. Yeah. There's no such thing as an atheist in a foxhole, and I'm thinking about Curtin. I'd like you to zero in on him.
Sure.
Who, in the biopic, was it about a year and a half ago? It featured him when the fleet was coming back from North Africa, and however many thousand men on that to defend Australia. And he is seen kneeling with, I think it's his private secretary, who was a Church of Christ lay leader.
Correct.
And praying the Navy Prayer. Is that accurate? And does that reflect who what he was really about?
Yes, I argue in the book, Curtin was a late convert. He was raised a Catholic.
But he's an atheist hero, don't you know that?
Well, he wasn't an atheist.
He
wasn't an atheist. He certainly left the Catholic Church. He was raised in a Catholic family. For a variety of reasons, he moved away from Catholicism. He married a Protestant. But in his late years, and there's a good argument that it was actually the war, the strains of leadership during the war, and his private secretary, that chap you're talking about, Fred McLaughlin was his name, who encouraged him to pray. He had other friends too. There was a country party member named Hunter he was close to. He used to wander around the botanical gardens talking about Christianity, apparently, during the height of the war. But there's some very good evidence that Curtin, towards the end of his life, came to a Protestant form of faith. He was buried in the Presbyterian plot of the Karrakatta Cemetery in Perth. And he befriended, towards the end, a man called Hector Harrison, who was the Presbyterian minister in Canberra, and went on to an eminent career. It's not absolutely clear-cut, but there's some pretty good evidence that Curtin did make a late conversion.
So we go to James, Anne and Alan. Yeah. Let's go. James?
A couple of leaders of the opposition had fairly extreme views on religion by Australian standards, John Latham and Arthur Call. Do you think the Australians weren't prepared to put up with that, and that was the reason why they didn't become Prime Minister?
Question on the attitude of the religion of John Latham and Arthur Call.
Well, John Latham was undoubtedly the most genuine atheist ever to lead either of the major political parties. He led the UAP. The UAP asked him to stand aside so Joe Lyons could come in and lead the party to victory against Scullin. And indeed, speaking of Curtin, Curtin actually blamed Latham for his loss of faith, his initial loss of Catholic faith, because Latham used to give lectures in Melbourne at the Rationalist Society, which Curtin went along to as a young man. So yeah, Latham and he also led Bruce astray in the 1920s, arguably partly to blame for Bruce's terrible loss in 1929. The other Latham, Mark, was often accused of being an atheist. And I sort of held that assumption myself until I did some research and then found a very interesting quotation from 6 or 7 years ago where Latham actually said, no, I'm inclined to believe there is a God, but I just haven't quite got my head around all of the nuances of any one religion. Who was the other? Oh, Corwell. Corwell was made what's the word for it, Gerard?
A papal knight,
and extraordinary man. Yes, he probably was unelectable, has to be said. But
well, he was unelected.
Yeah.
Three times.
Indeed. Imagine that now. The Labor Party allowing a bloke three chances.
It was Bert Evatt too. Three losses. And.
It's interesting, this whole question of faith, religion, whatever. We've never had a more or less of a practiced religious society. I mean, Australia's always been a bit secular, but very few people go to church. Yet, leaders, prime ministers such as Lyons, Menzies, who were a long time, even John Howard, and John Howard says in your book, you quote him saying, Australians tend to be a little secular in the way they practice their religion, even if they are religious.
Yes.
All of them were very, I'd say, cautious about proclaiming their religious background, seeing themselves in a public role as a religious figure in any way, shape or form. They were religious in their private life, but they didn't parade it. How is it that we have a Prime Minister now who gives media conferences outside church and actually alerts the media that he's going to be at church on Sunday, so they'll be there with their cameras. Why do we that now, in this secular time, want that person to be our Prime Minister? What's happened?
Well, I think, Anne, the political answer is simply this. During the John Howard era, coalition, rightly or wrongly, was perceived as having wrapped up the Christian vote, so to speak. Certainly the Protestant Christian vote. Not so much John Howard, but certainly others within the coalition sort of actively trumpeted themselves in that way. And certainly in the initial stages, I think Kevin Rudd, who, as I said, is a very serious Christian, bristled at the idea that either side of politics should own the Christian vote. And he made no secret of the fact that he went out there as opposition leader and, or indeed before he became opposition leader, to reconnect Labor with its very honourable Christian tradition that I refer to, Fisher and people like that. Fisher's the Prime Minister that Rudd most admires, the other Queenslander. I think it's arguable that Rudd, as Prime Minister, did go a bit over the top. Clearly seems to have offended some people. But it's interesting that at the 2007 election, Labor got its biggest swings by far in regional low-income seats with high proportions of evangelical Protestant voters. Now, they're voters who deeply distrusted Labor for a long time, but connected with Rudd. And Rudd, until his cave in on the ETS, Rudd was the most popular Prime Minister in Australian history as measured consistently in opinion polls. His rating was up in the 60s, if not the 70s, for a long time. And I argue in the book that had a lot to do. Now, it may have been cynical politics, possibly was in some respects, but no more cynical than a lot of other politicians. It worked in terms of electoral appeal. And when Julia Gillard replaced him, in a sense, she was on a hiding to nothing, whether she was an atheist or not. She was certainly perceived that way. And Labor's vote collapsed, especially in places like Queensland, especially in regional Queensland, which is the very place now where Labor amazingly may even have a chance of pulling off the election. It's what there's a professor of politics at the University of Queensland called John Harrison who refers to the Bonhoeffer effect. And there is quite a lot of empirical evidence to support it.
Now we go to Alan, then we come up here. Got to be brief, yeah?
I was at the funeral of Francis James, the journalist, a few years ago.
Yes.
And seated next to me was David Hill, who was Amy Charles ran the ABC. We were chatting outside the church afterwards, and up came Gough Whitlam.
Yes.
And in a loud voice, he said, "I think there's too much religion on the ABC." That surprised me a little. And I was wondering if he was just trying to be a bit cheeky
I think as usual, he was probably had his tongue firmly in his cheek. Say this about Gough, with the possible exception of Deakin, no Prime Minister knows more about Christianity than Whitlam. His knowledge of theology and church history, architecture, is second to none. Now, and his father was an extremely pious Baptist. Margaret was a believer. He was steeped in it. Now, Francis James famously, I can't resist this, Francis James famously beat him. This might have been the reason for this little exchange you heard, sir. Francis James beat him out for the Divinity Prize, Canberra Grammar, in 1934. Even though Whitlam had actually scored the top mark in the exam. Even though Whitlam got the top mark and Canon Edwards, the headmaster, admitted that Whitlam's paper was superb. But I'm giving the award to James, the second place getter, because James actually believes it. And James, of course, went on an extraordinary career. He was the editor of the Melbourne Anglican. He served time in a Chinese jail for espionage, and then he gave this amazing press conference with Gough when he was Prime Minister, lauding his practical application of Christian principles. It's actually a scream. I unashamedly lifted it and put it in the book. So that's Gough.
Yep.
Could you explain why we've had Catholic prime ministers in Australia long before they ever had a Catholic president in America?
Yeah, that's a simple question of demographics, because the proportion of Catholics in Australia has always been considerably greater than the proportion of Catholics in the American population. Indeed, Kennedy is still the one and only Catholic ever to be elected president, whereas we've had now five or six Catholic prime ministers, and we're about probably to get the first from the Liberal Party.
Right, there's a discussion here, and I'll come down to Tom. Let me finish up. Yep.
Yes, Roy, you mentioned earlier in your address that Harold Holt was the odd man out. What do you suppose were the main factors that caused Harold Holt to be the odd man out?
He had a terrible upbringing. It's true. His parents were dissolute sort of characters, and he was shunted around geographically and very lonely, boarding school. They got no Christian education worthy of the name. And it really is a case of his upbringing.
What was his school? Which boarding school?
He went to the Methodist school in Wesley College in Melbourne. Yeah.
Tom, final question.
Roy, as to your human rights risks, in your research, did you unearth any other values other than the religious values that underpinned or material to Paul Keating's concepts of inclusion and belonging that was so outstanding, extraordinary, compared to the prime ministers before him and those since?
Which about Paul Keating's concept of inclusion and belonging?
The short answer is no. I mean, his Catholicism was absolutely central. I remember writing an article for the Bible Society a couple of years ago, making this claim and referring to human rights and like issues, indigenous issues, so forth. And it was on the Drum, the notorious ABC. And I got various bloggers writing in saying, oh, this is outrageous. I can't believe Keating's a Christian. I much prefer my heroes to be thinking people. I didn't bother responding. But all I can say is, I guess, read my chapter about Keating. But everything he said publicly on this subject very much goes back to his Catholic upbringing.
Final question. This is your second book now.
Yes.
You gave away a good law practice in Sydney to write books, so there must be something else coming up, I assume. What else are you working on?
A couple of projects, actually, but my real aim, Jared, is to write a book about the law in the style of God, actually. The working title is Law, actually. So what is the law really about? All aspects of it, history, practice, philosophy, and so on.
Profane to the secular, eh? The other way.
Well, there was once an English common law judge, only a few hundred years ago, who said Christianity is part and parcel of the law of England. And we inherited that. Although I don't think it's any longer true.
Many thanks. Roy, I'm sure Roy will be happy to sign some copies of his book, In God We Trust, In God They Trust? It's been a terrific presentation tonight, and a lot of interest in the talk, and it's a very well-written and very well-argued thesis in the individual cases of the 23 prime ministers that are covered. Also, the book is very marketable.
1995, I understand, is the price. We're making a contribution tonight, and you get it here for the special price of $20 because we don't have any change. But it's still pretty marketable. So congratulations to the author and the Bible Society. But tonight, Roy, well done. I'm sure you'll be back again in the future, but for tonight, well done.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.